All right, guys, welcome back to the Relay Bitcoin podcast. Today we have a pretty funny guest. Like, I'm already shitting myself laughing. It's Brad Mills, who's tuning in from Canada. Obviously a legendary Bitcoiner. You guys probably know him from @BradMillsCanDoIt on Twitter. Hi, Brad. Thank you very much for taking the time. I know you're very busy.
Thanks. I didn't even know we were going to do a podcast. I thought we were just going to do a catch-up call. But well, I guess we can do a podcast.
We can do both.
I got my podcast light turned on.
We can do both, man. We can just catch up and people are watching it.
Yeah, we should talk more for another 45 minutes about my lights and my white balance on my camera. And I'd say we got another 45 minutes in us to talk about that.
Absolutely.
Or Bitcoin. Or Bitcoin, we could do that.
I mean, let's start maybe with Bitcoin. And I think we have enough to talk about Bitcoin. But like, if we have some more time, I'm happy to talk about your block watch and your neon lights. But no, I really like the setup. So everyone who's listening now on like Spotify or whatever, just switch to YouTube and maybe watch this beautiful setup. It's really cool. You can tell you invested some time in it.
Yeah, well, I spent a lot of money on that block clock because I bought it with Bitcoin. So you can tell I really want to focus on the block clock. You can see in the background if you're watching, I've got a whole neon light setup pointing towards it.
Yeah,
it's probably a bad investment.
When did you buy it? Depends on when you bought it. If you bought Bitcoin
it
was 60K,
it was when Bitcoin was very low. It's when Bitcoin was like $1,500 or something like that.
Oh,
so that's a one Bitcoin piece of art back there.
Yeah,
so, man, I have to really, really treat it like the art it is.
It makes it really, really valuable. There's this one article, I think Joe Hall. The journalist for Cointelegraph, he wrote a whole article.
Oh, yeah.
He was also in Amsterdam, by the way. And he wrote this whole article about people buying shit when Bitcoin was still very low. And now, like, and then he projected the value that it would have now. So, for example, I told him I bought a hoodie, something like that. Back in, what was it, like around 17, it was probably also around maybe 2K or 3K per coin. And then you know it's a very valuable hoodie now. So, but these are funny stories. What's the most valuable thing you bought?
Oh man, well, I don't keep track of it because just torturing yourself, right? But that's probably the most recent one, and it was like I wanted to do it because I kind of wanted it to be a statement of the value, and I would always remember how much I spent on the block clock, because if it had been like 0.531337 or something like that, I probably would have forgot about it. But I paid one whole Bitcoin for that block clock on purpose. Like I upaid. So I gave him a whole Bitcoin. All right.
And I mean, you knew it was stupid back then already, right? Like you knew this would.
Yeah,
be...
I was like, I was looking at it like I was supporting an artist. I was trying to help CoinKite get through the bear market, I guess. But because it displays the price of Bitcoin on it, so I was like, well, if I pay one Bitcoin for it, then it displays the price of Bitcoin always live updating me. It'll always tell me how much I could have not spent on this device. Mm-hmm. So it's been fun. But I find that having the price always in your face is stressful, both on the upswings and the downswing.
Yeah,
you find that like people focusing on price too much, it causes anxiety because you start to index too hard on the price of Bitcoin. So I ended up having to turn off the block clock from showing the price, and now it just shows like a message that says one Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin.
I think this is the most calming thing you can do. Otherwise, you will always get very stressed and very nervous. Like as you said, it's either fear or greed. Like if it goes up, you're greedy. You think like you don't have enough. You have FOMO. You want to buy more. And if it's going down, people get anxiety or fear that it's now it's going to crash. I mean, not probably not you, because you're in it for such a long time. Also, I don't really get this fear anymore. Maybe a little bit sometimes. I still worry if the price goes down, because, you know. But probably newcomers, and there's some newcomers listening here, they're very fearful probably if they bought at 30k and it goes below 20k, they probably feel the urge of selling, like getting out. What do you still talk to people like that, and what do you tell them, like how to deal with
that? Yeah, even Bitcoiners are like that, you know, like Bitcoin Tina recently kind of made some waves in the Bitcoin community. For he has this name Bitcoin Tina, which stands for there is no alternative, and he made quite a stir with his like verbose Al Franken style attacks on people who were dumb enough to sell Bitcoin, et cetera, et cetera. He's like in his 60s, and he was basically all in Bitcoin. And, you know, he recently kind of changed his position, and he's maybe like 40% Bitcoin. And people are roasting him because, you know, Bitcoin Tina, T-I-N-A, there is no alternative. It's just kind of like they're roasting him because, well, I guess there is an alternative for him. There is the dollars. So he's more heavy into dollars now than he is into Bitcoin. But he's still 40% of his net worth is in Bitcoin, or whatever, 30, whatever it is. That's still a lot. Like most people getting into Bitcoin or even, you know, thinking 10, 20% is a lot. There's a very small amount of people where all in Bitcoin actually is a healthy thing for them, because the pressure to sell on both upswings becomes too great. The pressure to want to trade and stop looking at it like it's a long-term savings technology and start looking at it like it's, I got to manage this, like an active fund manager, becomes too great when you're way too heavy in Bitcoin. So like somebody like American HODL, who's 100% in Bitcoin of his liquid net worth, I mean, his real estate and stuff too, young, you know, if Bitcoin really does go to 5K, like some of these talking heads on Twitter are saying, well, he's got the capacity to go make more money and stack more sats when it's cheap. But somebody that's in their 60s, that's retired, it's very difficult for them to actually stay all in Bitcoin when you've got the current conditions in the market, because like the pressure is too great to need to have short-term liquidity to live off of.
Yeah.
So
that's, yeah. I heard in a presentation, it was not at this conference, not at the Amsterdam one, but in the Innsbruck one. In Innsbruck, like 1 or 2 months ago, there was this biggest German-speaking Bitcoin conference. It was huge, even though it was the bear market. There were almost 1,000 people there. It was great, and great German speakers as well. Michael Saylor was speaking as well, not in German, unfortunately, even though he said he can speak German, but he didn't do it in German. But it was great. And there was one guy who talked about the volatility and exactly what you said. Like, it's not the time yet where you can be all in Bitcoin, because it's just volatile, and then you will be forced, in the worst timing, you will be forced to sell, because you still have taxes and bills to pay in fiat. But still, if you have a long term perspective, he said something along the lines like, look, fiat is short term stable, but long term it trends downwards. And Bitcoin is the opposite. It's short-term volatile, but long-term it's kind of stable and trending upwards. And that was really fascinating to me. And this is really, I think, at the time being now, I mean, 10 years ago when you came into Bitcoin, it was probably different. And in 10 years, it will be different. But now, this is really, I think, how people should think about it.
You know, funny enough, it was pretty similar 10 years ago. Like, okay, we've talked about this on Clubhouse quite a bit. A lot of us kind of still hang out on Clubhouse. Clubhouse was very popular about a year and a half ago. It's this app you can download. It was before Twitter Spaces. And a bunch of us still go in and hang out there. If people are listening, they want to just kind of chill with folks like Bitcoin Tina and myself, American HODL. Lots of other Bitcoiners go in there, and we just kind of shoot the shit and hang out. And anyways, this was one of the things where some people that were talking about, like, what does it feel like this last year? Is it similar to any other previous cycle? And a bunch of people are saying, oh, it's kind of like 2017 or it's kind of like 2013. But I honestly think it feels like anybody that's gotten into Bitcoin in 2020 or 2021, they're kind of like OGs, in my opinion, already. Because this, nobody has ever experienced what we've experienced over the last 18 months or even 12 months with Bitcoin. I mean, we had one of the biggest things to ever happen to Bitcoin happen, where China, which was like the biggest source of hash power, banned Bitcoin. We had a 6102 event. We always talked about like Bitcoin is proof that, or it's government proof. It's like insurance against a 6102 attack, where they say it's illegal to own it. And we had that happen for one of the biggest countries in the world. Mm. So Bitcoin survived that. It caused massive drawdown. Then we had another crazy rip up to $69,420 total simulation number. And another brutal drawdown that was 75%, 80%, whatever it is. So if you held through that, in my opinion, you've pretty much got the same exact experience as I had in 2011 or any of the other cycles. Because back in 2011, it was pretty similar too. Like the advice would have been like, you know, just don't sell it. Just buy it, hold it. Don't try to become a trader. Get yourself to a percentage of your net worth in Bitcoin and just think about it long term. Because if it does what we think and one day it could go to $1,000, you'd be great.
Well, that's kind of like, was $1,000 back then the equivalent of like 100K now? Or even
yeah. Yeah, so it was like $10 when I first got into Bitcoin.
Oh my god.
When I first heard about Bitcoin, it was $5. And by the time I got my money on the exchange, it was $10. So I was like, oh shit, I missed it. I already went up 2x. Like, this sucks.
It's done now.
It's over. I'll buy some anyway. Yeah, it's over. No, but people were saying like one day it could go to $1,000. So I was like, all right, well, I'm going to get some of this then anyways. And then it went up to $30 in like a matter of a month or two. Typical Bitcoin parabolic move, right? Mm-hmm. And I was so excited, but I thought, well, I should probably sell and take profits. That's the thing that everybody tells you to do, take profits. So I sold half my coin at $30, thinking I was a genius for making this great trade. And then it dropped to $2 over the next 6 months. So it was a pretty wild ride up and down over about 6 months to a year of when I got into Bitcoin. And I mean, it's the same exact advice now. Like, I wish I had never sold the Bitcoin, the same way people right now who are selling, you know, maybe they sold at 30K and they see it's now under 20 and they're thinking, oh, well, I guess I'm a smart trader. That was a good move. Mm-hmm. But really what that does is it just builds bad habits, because you think you're a good trader, but this is not an instrument that you should be trying to trade.
It's impossible.
Unless you're a professional and that's your job, and you're going to spend time learning about portfolio management theory and risk management and counterparty risk and all these things, all these landmines, because I ended up losing in Mt. Gox and multiple other cryptocurrency exchanges. I mean, I've made all the mistakes in my journey of being a Bitcoiner to where now I've got multi-sig with Casa protecting myself from exchange hacks from myself, because there's always degenerate urges you get to want to go gamble on something or spend your Bitcoin, or you get pressured by other people saying, oh, we're going into a depression and Bitcoin's going to 5K, and you got that urge to want to maybe sell some. Mm. But I think the best advice for people today is what most Bitcoiners say and what it's been always. I mean, yeah, you can look back and say, oh, I could have sold the top, or I could have bought more at the bottom. But the better thing is to build good habits and always focus on thinking about it in a very long-term time frame. 10 years is typically what I tell everybody, like my friends and stuff, when they're getting into it. And just keep stacking, keep learning about how to properly custody your Bitcoin and protect yourself from your own urges, because you're going to want to trade it, because it does move up in a very volatile way.
So since when are you on a DCA, like auto savings plan, stacking sats like automatically every week or every month? And if yes, since when? Like when did you have this insight where it was, okay, yes, this is volatile, but on the long run it's gonna go up and this is savings technology and I wanna have more and more of this digital gold? Like
Dude, I'm still learning. 10 years, 11 years later, it's tough. It really, you know what it feels like? It feels like I'm a 75-year-old man that's lived through an entire investment lifetime, gone through multiple depressions, and like has had life-changing gains from my investments. But you know, like I'm still learning because this you do like the things change and you do start to want to become a risk manager or trader, whatever. So I never actually did DCA as a strategy because I just went all in basically. I didn't have a lot of money back in 2011 when I first heard about Bitcoin. Actually, sorry, that's a lie. I didn't go all in. Peter Schiff convinced me to buy some silver and some gold because I was watching him on YouTube. And over 10 years, the gold is up like at least 40%. So I'm doing pretty good there. The silver's still down 50% in 10 years. So that's not doing too good. That's not
Really?
doing too good. Yeah. I bought at the top, the generational top of silver. And I keep that as a memento. I should hang that on the wall next to the block clock. And then, but thankfully, Bitcoin's up like, you know, 200,000% or something. So it's kind of made up for Peter Schiff's advice.
That's kind of all right. Who gave you that
Yeah,
advice?
it's all right.
Who brought you into Bitcoin? Like, who convinced you to buy Bitcoin?
So I was watching. I had a little bit of money extra. I had some success as an entrepreneur building apps on Facebook, and for the first time in my life, I had like extra money sitting around because I grew up in poverty on the East Coast of Canada, where I celebrated more like I wanted to celebrate my first government check when I got fired. Then I celebrated the job that I got fired from. So when I got my first job, it was like, oh yeah, one day I can get fired from this and get my EI check. That was the mentality I grew up with. So it was kind of funny. So I didn't have a good financial literacy, you know, situation around me. Nobody really owned properties or anything like that. It was not many middle class. It was kind of like growing up in a bit of a depression there. It was like 45% unemployment rate. So when I had some success, I did not have a background of money and understanding the importance of thinking long term in terms of savings, because our generation grew up with you don't make any money on your money. You get no interest. And the bank just rapes you in high fees. Even if you do have 1 or 2%, you're going to lose it all the fees anyway. So we kind of had this disincentive to save growing up. So it wasn't until I had a little bit of extra money coming in from the business, I started like thinking, what do I do with it? Do I buy stocks? Like that seems like a Ponzi scam, because after the bailouts in 2008 and like Occupy Wall Street and stuff was happening, it's like these guys are just all like pump and dump scam artists in the stock market. That everything's overvalued. I don't want to put my money there. So it was like Rich Dad, Poor Dad, Robert Kiyosaki, Peter Schiff, folks like that. And then also being super into Ron Paul at the time. And he was talking about the history of money and how dollars are debased over time. And he had he was in this documentary I saw called America, Freedom to Fascism, which was kind of a conspiratorial documentary. Now that I look back at it, I watched it again recently. It was pretty conspiratorial, but it was about how the income tax never used to be part of American history, and it was introduced as a temporary measure in the war. And they don't really have authority to do it, and they don't have moral authority to steal your money. And most of the tax that gets collected in income tax goes to pay down the interest on the national debt. And then they got into who gets this interest. Why does this private corporation, the Federal Reserve, get to control the money supply and change the interest rates and manipulate the market? And who keeps them accountable? I mean, it really blew my mind when I started back then to learn about money. So I thought, well, this is a big scam. I'm in a cult here, a money cult, my whole life. I've been born into this like cult where I have to just sacrifice any value I might earn in my life to these private banking cartel guys. So I was just like, whatever I can do to like screw them over, I'm going to do it. And that was opting out of the fiat system with Bitcoin. So, well, it was gold, silver, and Bitcoin. Those are the three things that I was interested in. And the reason it was Bitcoin is because there was this dude on YouTube who was showing you how to import gold to Canada without paying double taxes, because there's this stupid thing in Canada where if you get anything at the border, they typically charge you a lot of taxes and then fees and all this stuff. So he was like, write this code down on the package and you won't get any taxes on it because it's not supposed to be taxed if it's bullion or whatever. And then he's like, but then there's this Bitcoin thing that's like digital gold. And if you have a computer, you can download Bitcoin and, you know, maybe it'll be worth like $100 one day. And right now it's like $2 or $5. He was making videos about it since it was $1. So for like 4 months or something already. So, I mean, that dude's still in.
Is he?
I talked to him. Yeah, he is. I talked to him occasionally. He's moved to Dubai. He's divorced his wife. He's like, he's totally changed his life. And he's like, now he's actually like shilling shit coins. Oh. So I think he sold too much of his Bitcoin and he had to let, he got into the pre-mine game and started shilling shit coins and doing trading courses and stuff. But he, you know, that's why I don't like saying his name too much, because I don't want people to go look into him and then go start playing Ripple and stuff.
Well, this is, but this
but
is
he still
like
loves Bitcoin.
He still loves Bitcoin. Okay, but like this is the other way around. Like usually you come into like the journey is coming into Bitcoin, getting involved in shitcoins, and then going back to Bitcoin only. But he basically got into Bitcoin and then to shitcoin, and then he stayed. It's kind of
well, funny. Like a lot of us in the early days sold too early, and when you have that high watermark in Bitcoin terms, and then you see Bitcoin rip. And you're like, oh, yeah, I sold half my Bitcoin when it was $30 and now it's $1,000. What can I do to get more Bitcoin? And, you know, some people start to think, well, I can trade. I can swing trade Bitcoin and then make more. And then some people say, well, I can start my own coin because I know all about Bitcoin. So I'm going to start my own coin. And other people just say, well, I'm just going to invest in altcoins and trade them. So typically that's been the path that most of my friends from the early days went to. It's rare for somebody like, you know, to just stay Bitcoin only. Typically everybody dabbles in altcoins at some point and learns a lesson. And people that go down the altcoin rabbit hole, like they end up either getting lucky and making money on it and then thinking they're smart and like staying in altcoins and becoming a crypto person. Or they end up losing all their money and giving their Bitcoin to the altcoin founders and the VCs that pre-mined it and giving it all back to the market. And then they kind of give up on Bitcoin, or they learn the lesson and they become a Bitcoiner. Like you said, like they become a Bitcoin maximalist and they realize everything else is 99% of it is just like insider pump and dump penny stock type stuff.
Yeah.
And they go back to Bitcoin and they go back with that long-term savings mentality. And then some of us even end up like getting a job and making some money and buying more Bitcoin that way.
I think that's actually the most rational thing to do for most people. Like,
because but it's the last thing you think about, right? Wait, maybe I can work
and earn some fiat money that I can then convert
fiat money.
Yeah, but that's the most secure thing. Like, you cannot save long term in Bitcoin. Like, I have most respect of people who are entrepreneurial in Bitcoin. I mean, I'm a kind of Bitcoin entrepreneur myself, but it's not the rational thing to do because I don't have a very good salary. I could probably earn double what I'm earning now, and I could just hardcore stack this into Bitcoin. I would end up more wealthy. I mean, depending on how the venture goes, obviously, but we all know that 9 out of 10 ventures go bankrupt at one point.
It's risky.
So if I'm in a 10%, it's great. I'm going to be super wealthy, but most likely, I mean, it is. There is a chance that I'll be in the 90%, And so then in the end, in like 10 years, I'd probably be less wealthy than if I just take a very easy job at like a big Swiss bank or something and earn like 10, 15K a month. I mean, that's right. The reality in Switzerland. I mean, imagine I could almost buy right now, I could almost buy probably not one Bitcoin, but like half a Bitcoin per month. And I could do
per
this.
Per month, yeah.
I could do this.
Now that's a good stack, Paul.
Yeah, man, that would be amazing. But like, I can obviously not do that now. But yeah, it's for most people, it's just the risk adjusted. I mean, it's the lowest risk thing you can do. Just earn fiat money and stack it.
Yeah, it is. And it's the most likely path for 99% of the world that doesn't, like, most people are not traders. Most people don't trade penny stocks or even stocks. I mean, in the book, When Money Dies, I think Adam Ferguson is the author of that book. It's a really good book about the fall of the currency in Weimar Germany mm-hmm. and what life was like to live in Weimar Germany during, before and after, or like right around the hyperinflation event. And one of the things I took away from that book was that about 8 to 10% of the population was actually making money speculating and trading on things like commodities and foreign currencies. And they were not working their jobs because they were making more money speculating.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of disruption in the markets is caused by money that is like messing up the ruler,
yep.
you know, of how we value things. And when the money is being debased and printed, it does show up in extreme volatility in markets and lots of crazy bubbles form, and you can make a lot of money easily doing it. So that is what happened here in the last 2 years when the futures, all like Wall Street Bets, started making bankrupt stocks pump, like Hertz and stuff like that, where they pumped bankrupt companies to all-time highs, and the futures volume was like the most it's ever been by retail, and there's so many people making money trading stocks, like stocks can only go up. Dave Sportnoy or whatever his name is, what made that popular. But it's very similar. The parallels between the death of money in Germany in the 1930s and the death of money currently in the West
mm-hmm.
and really all over the world is very similar, because CNBC, I think it was, did a poll last year to ask people, have you quit your job or do you know somebody who's quit their job and instead make their money trading cryptocurrencies
mm-hmm.
or anything else? And between 8 to 10% of the people that responded either had themselves or knew somebody in their close circle that had quit their job to become a full-time trader.
Same thing. Like
it's the exact,
70 years ago.
Yeah.
Or 80 years ago.
So it's the exact same thing. And so like that is an abnormal situation to be in, where it's so easy to make money that you can just quit your job and you don't have to work and you're going to get rich. But then what ends up happening? Well, that volatility to the upside switches to volatility mm-hmm. to the downside. And anybody who's been doing that, thinking they're so smart, they get wrecked mm-hmm. and they end up having to go back, and they've set themselves back how many years, who knows, maybe they lost their life savings. The lucky 2 or 3% made a bunch of money and now they can sort of figure it out. But
mm-hmm.
most of the people end up losing. So that's why Bitcoiners have the best advice. That's just work, invest in Bitcoin as a savings technology, think about it long term, and protect your savings, your Bitcoin savings, from your urges, because maybe you are smart enough to beat the market. Maybe you're that exception, that 1% who has the edge, and you can follow your rules and you can emotionlessly execute trades. You've got a great mathematical formula for trend following or whatever it is. Maybe that's you, but even still, you got to follow risk management. So another great book I'd recommend people read if they're ever thinking about doing any kind of speculation or trading is Well, there's a bunch of books by Michael Covell, trend following books. Trend Commandments is a good one. The Complete Turtle Trader is a really good book. Those books are really good to teach you about risk management. And then there's this book called What I Learned Losing $1 Million. You can just read the first half of it. You don't even need to read the whole book. Just read the first half or listen to it on Audible or whatever. What I Learned Losing $1 Million, a really good book. And then for entertainment purposes and also educational purposes, The Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, also an awesome book. I don't know if you've read that one.
No, I haven't. I'm not into trading or like at all.
Well, so you asked me like, what do? I DCA or whatever? No, because I got into Bitcoin so early that it's changed my life, even through all the mistakes I've made. I've lost so much.
So you went all in super early, and like early in your journey as well. Like many people need 5-6 years until they go all in, and many never go all in. You seem to be going all in. Well, you went all in after 1 or 2 years being into that, or not even. Like, how did you go in all in so early, and how could you keep yourself from selling?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
I didn't go all in. Like I said, all in earlier, and then I corrected myself because I went like 33%. Gold, 33% silver, 33% Bitcoin. I was just like, I'm not smart enough to know what's going to win, but I really love this digital gold thing, so I'm going to buy some. And then it went way up and silver was going down. So I was like, I'm going to rebalance. That's a typical noob thing. Mm-hmm. I'm going to rebalance my portfolio and diversify back out of Bitcoin and into the other stuff. So I sold half my Bitcoin when it was 30. Trying to be a trader and trying to rebalance without having any knowledge of trading or anything like that. It was just like people tell you all the time, mm-hmm. it's never too late to take some off the table. It's not a bad idea to take profits. You just have these preconceptions about what you should do. And that's why that's really dumb advice for new people that are just trying to get to a percentage goal. I mean, if you're new and you're just trying to get to say 10% of your net worth in Bitcoin, just forget about taking profits and all that stuff. Just keep stacking. If you're in a drawdown, doesn't matter. You're just dollar cost averaging in, and eventually you'll have an average price of when you get to say 10% of your net worth in Bitcoin. Maybe then you shift to risk management mode and diversification and all those different things. But 10% is, that's like basic. 5-10% is the basic risk advice that most people can handle. But as you learn more about Bitcoin, you get more conviction, you definitely want to up your percentage in Bitcoin. Mm. Most of us end up trying to get as much as we possibly can in Bitcoin. And then you, when Bitcoin does become the majority of your portfolio, of your net worth, then you start to really think about risk management and like, do I really want to sit through another 75% loss in my net worth? Maybe I should take some profits. Maybe I should buy some real estate. Maybe I should trade it, whatever. So over the years, for me, it's been a journey of trying to figure out what percentage of my gains I'm going to just take out for upgrading my lifestyle, mm-hmm. and changing the trajectory of my family. For kind of, like I said, we came from this like super poverty area. So I decided I was going to take gains from Bitcoin, buy some real estate so my family can have a nicer home to live in, mm-hmm. and pay my taxes, and then just have some money, some dirty fiat set aside so that in case shit hit the fan with Bitcoin, I was good. I could live off of, uh-huh. off that dirty cuck bucks. So, but then I met Jason Williams. You ever meet him?
No.
You see him on Twitter, Going Parabolic?
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. No, I know it. So, I know him on Twitter.
So I met Jason Williams and I was like, I don't have enough Bitcoin. And then Michael Saylor came on the scene and he starts buying like hundreds of millions of dollars of Bitcoin. And I'm like, damn it, I don't have enough Bitcoin. I need to get more Bitcoin. So, man, it's like always back and forth. And now I'm like, you know, now that the market's in a total bear market, I'm like, do I have enough Bitcoin? I think I got enough Bitcoin. I can survive. If Bitcoin goes to $1 million, like we all think it's going to by 2030, I'll be good. And then, you know, Michael Saylor buys another $500 million of Bitcoin in the bear market. I'm like, shit, I have to get more Bitcoin.
This guy has balls.
So I don't have a DCA. I really am just driven by FOMO. I'm just a FOMO sapien. Like, whatever. So I protect myself from my Bitcoin. I can't access it. I have to take a plane flight in order to access my Bitcoin because I'm using Casa Multisig. So I don't have easy access to my Bitcoin. So the only thing I can do is just buy more on dips. That's what I do. I don't DCA. I just, whenever I get, so during the bull market, I had a rule for myself. Whenever I would buy Bitcoin, whenever we hit a new all-time high, whenever I got triggered by a shitcoiner, or whenever we had a dip. So I was spent the whole year buying Bitcoin, like nearly every day. I mean, I was always either getting triggered by shitcoin NFT tweets or something like Ethereum maximalist, like flooding Bitcoin. I was always getting triggered. It was like a year and a half of getting triggered and dips and all-time highs. So I stopped buying Bitcoin probably in 2014 or 15. And because I was into mining and stuff as well. I was trying to do it. You know, I had Bitcoin startups. I was mining. I was trying to do whatever I possibly could to make Bitcoin. And then I sort of shifted. I didn't sell any Bitcoin until 2017. It was my first time ever selling. And then that was when I said I cashed some out to have some fiat, some dirty cuck bucks, and to buy a house for my grandparents and my mom. And
that's
super
smart to do it when it hits an all-time high, right? Every time you kind of you made some fiat gains, then to put this into something that, as you said, upgrades your life or buy some hard asset, like other than Bitcoin, like real estate, for example, or invest in startup or whatever. Like, what do you do whenever you hit one of these all-time highs or whenever you think you made some good returns? What do you do typically with it to upgrade your life or just to make some dreams come true? What do you do with the Bitcoin?
So I pay my taxes so I can sleep at night. That's the one. The second is I've got a lot of friends that have like bought mansions and then bought Ferraris and they have like car addictions now, or they're buying all these cars and stuff like that. I look at my like, I kind of have a stoic philosophy perspective where so one thing that I really wanted a Tesla X. That was my dream car. When it was 2016 or so, I had set a goal for myself that if I work hard and I can achieve this financial goal, I'll buy myself a Tesla X. Mm-hmm. So in 2017, after about a year of like getting up at 5 a.m. and trying to like work hard and reading tons of books and just, you know, whatever. I ended up hitting this goal mostly because of Bitcoin, because just holding Bitcoin helped me hit this goal. But I was also doing, I got a job working at a fund and I was working hard at the fund and blah, blah, blah. So I hit the goal. And then I went and I thought, you know, Bitcoin's probably going to keep going. In Canada, Tesla X costs about like $230,000. It's like an expensive car. Yeah, fully loaded Tesla X.
Wow.
Costs a lot in Canada because our dollar is continually losing steam against the United States dollar. Mm. So it would have been about like $230,000 to buy that car, to, you know, get a loan on it and buy it or whatever. So I went to the Tesla dealership and I sat in the car and I had the feeling of, I could own this. Mm-hmm. I hit my goal. I could own this. And that was enough for me to have the feeling that I actually could accomplish the goal. And that was enough for me to postpone the gratification another couple of years. And instead, I decided to take the money that I would have spent on the Tesla X and buy a house for one of my family members to live in and do some renovations to my own house, you know, and things like, and I leased a comfortable Lincoln. a Lincoln MKX for a year and a half. I said, you know what? I'll lease this car. If after 2 years, I still really want this Tesla X, I'll buy it. So that's what I try to stop the urge to have crazy like self-gratification and think long-term. And that has made it so that I end up now I'm the slumlord. So I just own a lot of houses for my family's slumlord.
But that makes you more happy, right? Would it make you more happy to drive into in a car? Like all these material things, they give you a quick adrenaline kick when you buy it, but like a couple of weeks later, it's just normal. Whether you have a Lincoln or a Tesla or a Lambo, it doesn't really matter, I guess. Like it's not making you happy on the long term, but like buying your family houses, like this is gonna make you happy until you die.
It makes them happy for sure. It takes stress and pressure off them. A lot of people in Bitcoin say that they're stacking for their family or they're stacking for their friends or whatever, because sometimes it's very hard once you have conviction on Bitcoin to convey that to your close circle and to actually convince them to get Bitcoin and enough Bitcoin. So maybe they'll get like $500 of Bitcoin, they'll hold it or whatever and be like, oh yeah, it went up, it went down. But they don't typically dive into the problems with the world as deeply as Bitcoiners do. So that's literally what I did. I was stacking for my family, and that meme actually was a reality for me, literally and figuratively, because I did convince my dad and my sisters and stuff like that to buy their own Bitcoin. And they now have a long-term mindset. So for the first time in my family's life, like my, as far as I know, generations back, people actually have savings and they feel comfortable and they're thinking long term about the future because of Bitcoin, because they have Bitcoin. And people weren't going to, people in my family weren't going to, not everybody has the right condition to be able to do what you do, to be able to sacrifice working at the bank to potentially use your own energy to generate 100x the potential returns you would have made at the bank if you're successful with your own efforts. So not everybody has that entrepreneurial spirit. So I recognize that too. And instead of getting frustrated that I couldn't convince everybody to become like full-time Bitcoin maximalists like me, I just said, well, you know what? I'm going to give back when this does succeed and help upgrade the lifestyle and make things good for my family and some friends and stuff like that. And, I'm sure people do that too. Other people in Bitcoin, friends of mine, I mean, that were in early and it changed their lives. But I do see a lot of people not doing that.
Yeah, I mean, most people are not entrepreneurial. Most people are not into new technologies. Most people are not into like figuring out what's wrong with the world. They're just living. They're just getting by. They have a job. They can pay their bills. Everything is pretty. It's pretty okay for most of them. They also. Many people don't have the urge to change something or, they're just living a normal life and that's fine. But you were probably also one, like you mentioned, you were into entrepreneurship as well. You developed apps, you did Bitcoin startups, and now I know you are also angel investing into startups. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like what excites you there? Like what did you do in your entrepreneurial life and what are you looking now to kind of support as an angel investor?
Sure. Yeah. So I never went to business school or anything like that. I literally Googled, how do I make money online? Like that was my introduction to entrepreneurship.
Nice.
and I relate with the class of 2021 that came in to Bitcoin or even crypto through like BitBoy and all these crypto Ponzi shillers like Celsius and Luna and all that stuff that brought millions of people in to get scammed by all these con artists and digital snake oil salesmen, because I was that person that was just like no background in finance, no financial literacy. how do I literally Google, how do I make money online? And the first results on Google, wouldn't you know, are all scams. When you Google that, it's like, send us $50 and we'll send you 500.
Nice.
Because, you know, we'll send you a survey packet where you get paid $50 every survey you do. We have this exclusive resource where you can get thousands of dollars for doing surveys. You send the $50 and it's like, just gone, you know? So scams like that. There was also these high yield investment programs, which exactly are like yield farms and Ponzi schemes, like DeFi schemes, right? Yeah. Now. It was high yield investments. It was like back in early 2000s, you know, you put $500 into this advertising website, and they're going to show the ad to all of their members, and that's going to generate affiliate revenue, and that's going to earn you interest. And then if you refer people, you also get some interest. So before you know it, you might as well refer all your friends and family, and they should deposit $500, and then everybody's going to earn interest. And it's just great. Does that sound familiar?
That sounds familiar, man. Yeah. It's great until it's not great. until it stops, because
it's like Raoul Paul's investment thesis, you know, like Real Vision's investment thesis in 2021 was pretty much like high yield investment scams from the 2000s. It's given out to millions of people that follow them on YouTube. So it was just really frustrating seeing all this terrible investment advice and bad logic be pushed by respectful people like Tim Ferriss and Raoul Paul and Mike Novogratz and all these like super influential people in entrepreneur space, Gary Vee, all these people that I ended up, you know, so I got scammed a bunch trying to make money online. What ended up happening was I learned all the things not to do. And then I eventually found a book, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Oh, I love this one. It's such a classic, man. It was written like 80 years ago.
Yeah, it was like 100 years or something. It was a long time ago. And it was an audiobook, actually. I couldn't afford to buy a book at that time. I was so poor, I couldn't afford to buy a book. So I found a torrent of the audiobook of How to Win Friends and Influence People and The Richest Man in Babylon and like all these old sort of like money related self-help books, if you want to call them that. And I started listening to them, and I listened to How to Win Friends and Influence People. And I eventually like used some tactics I learned from that to try to get into sales. And then I started a sales company on the internet, and it was like making enough to pay my rent, you know, small amounts of money. And that kind of got into me getting into eGold, which was the precursor, one of the precursors to Bitcoin. eGold was like a website where in 2005-06 you could own digital gold on the internet from this company that was like digitizing gold vaults. They own gold and vaults, and it was an alternative to PayPal. And typically the Ponzi scams that were trying to scam me, and the advertising schemes and the high yield investment programs, they would want you to use alternative payment processors instead of PayPal, because PayPal would always catch on to the scams and freeze their accounts. eGold wouldn't. So eGold was like, in StormPay, I think, was another one. These were early payment processors that were just like, we'll take any client. Like, if you're going to scam people, we'll process your transactions. But I got some eGold to get into this like paid to do, I can't remember what it was, but anyways, that was one of the things that kind of made me realize, oh wait, you can have digital gold on the internet. That's pretty cool. So that was like something that I notched away for when I saw Bitcoin. It was just like a light bulb moment. Like, this is like eGold, except the government can't shut it down.
Right.
Because the government, the FBI, ended up shutting down eGold because it got very big, and it was kind of competing with online payments at the time, PayPal and the dollar. And, you know, they can't have that. They can't have some digital gold end up competing with the dollar. So they shut that down and stopped it in its tracks because it was centralized. They were able to just storm the office and take the gold. So then I got into, through years of getting scammed, actually starting a real company and making apps on Facebook. And they were just like virtual currency games. So I did that for a while. I was shocked that people would buy digital currency from me. Like it had no use. It was just earn social coins to play the game. And it was like the first wave of like before Farmville and all that stuff. It was actually like shitty graphics. Wasn't 3D graphics. It was just like social, literally like text almost games. Mm-hmm. Where people would just play this game. It was like at one point we had like 100,000 active players a month, just pulling slot, like not slot, but there's this thing in Canada called Roll Up the Rim to Win. I don't know if you've heard of that before. It's our biggest coffee company. They do this contest every year where you roll up the rim of the cup and you can win a donut or like a free coffee. So I was like, that's a good idea to put that digitally. Uh-huh. I'm going to put that on Facebook. And so I made a clone of this like successful contest in Canada, and 100,000 Canadians started playing this game, and it was a fake, it was like just virtual. It was like nothing real there, but they started spending money on the coins and all this stuff, and they just were database coins. So that ended up, I ended up hyperinflating the economy of that game and destroying the value of the currency. And so I ended up becoming like a central banker in the social digital game. And I learned the folly of printing too much money inside of my social game. But that was my entrepreneur journey. And I tried probably a good 100 different things. And
what did you do with that last company? That the one that was really successful with 100,000 of users? Did you sell that one or did you close it? Or
so that ended up dwindling away as it became very competitive. Big companies like EA and like Zynga became very popular. Big companies started to come into the space and made it very difficult. Like they drove up the cost of acquiring users and all that stuff. And their games were much better. Like they built way better games. They have teams of 100 people or more building these games, where I had like me and a guy that I met on Craigslist were just like pumping out these shitty games in our spare time. So I did try to scale that company up to keep up with the change in the industry. I ended up scaling up to like 20 employees and raised 1.2 or 3 million from some Hong Kong investors, which was a crazy story that I just kind of like manifested from nothing. We were basically gonna go bankrupt, and there was no other option. I like had to raise money to try to compete with these guys because the income started dwindling because they were stealing all of our players with their actual good games, and I needed to make some actual good games. So I ended up raising, and then I scaled up the team, and we pumped out another 100 games. We had one or two of them go to like we did a lot, and we had one or two of them go to like the top 10 iOS like free games charts and got a million downloads or whatever. And but it was the wrong move in the end. I scaled up too fast. I couldn't execute the plan that I'd set out. I wanted to do a roll up of a bunch of indie game companies and like create one big network. I couldn't execute that. I had problems raising the rest of the money, and I had to lay the whole staff off. So it was probably like late 2013, when Bitcoin went on a rip to over $1,000. I was actually like by myself, but still had Bitcoin. So I was like messing around on Mt. Gox during work hours because I couldn't take my focus away from Bitcoin because it was tearing again. So I was actually making more money just by myself trading on Mt. Gox than the whole company was with all my 20 employees making these 100 games. So I was like, why am I torturing myself making all these games and dealing all these interpersonal issues? I'm just going to like shut the company down and just trade on Mt. Gox. This is like so much better. Like
it sounds logical when you say it.
Yeah. So I did that, and then Mt. Gox got hacked and shut down, and I lost a lot of those gains on Mt. Gox.
Oh no.
Yeah, I got goxed. So I know what it's like to be an entrepreneur and to make a bunch of stupid decisions outside of entrepreneurship and inside of entrepreneurship. So but the one thing that saved me was just holding Bitcoin like continually, no matter what happened, no matter what adversity I had, no matter what the markets were doing. I just knew that I had to get back some Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I had to mine. I had to do whatever I could to try to get Bitcoin again. I literally, like, it slipped through my hands so many times in the last 10 years until I learned enough lessons about counterparty risk, risk management, portfolio management risk, all the things like that you don't understand when you first get into it and you start thinking, I'm so smart, I'm going to trade this thing, or I'm going to time the market, and I'm going to mine Bitcoin. Like, I'm going to invest in mining, like all the different things you think you can do. You can probably fail very easily at every one of them. But the one thing that's very easy to do, if you just set yourself to it, is just to think about it as a savings account and just hold on to it. Like, do whatever you possibly can to just protect yourself from yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm such a big fan of the multi-sig stuff. Mm-hmm. Because it does make it more difficult for you to screw yourself over. Sure, you can take risks with some savings you have or some of your Bitcoin if you want, like, of course, but you should always try to protect yourself, your main stack, like, separate it in buckets and have a basket that's just like generational wealth basket that you will never touch, that you can't touch, time lock it if you can. Mm-hmm. And whatever percentage that is for you, doesn't matter what the price is. If it goes up to 1 million, if it goes down to 5,000, you're never going to touch it. Mm-hmm. And if you have that perspective with some of your Bitcoin, it's say 5% of your net worth, 10% of your net worth, whatever that is for you, whatever makes you comfortable, you're either going to, one, change your whole family's trajectory forever, or two, you're going to lose it all. And like, who cares? It's only 5 or 10%. So if it does go to zero, like Peter Schiff thinks, it's only 5 or 10%. Who cares? And the rest of it, you can manage it and try to do whatever you want with it. You start a startup, you can mine, you can trade it for fiat, whatever you want to do. But just always have that basket that you will never touch, I think, is the most important thing that I learned over the last.
And then you have
years.
I mean, it's super valuable advice, because then you have a limited downside. Like, you can set yourself the limit, and then it cannot go lower than zero, right? So if you have 10% of your net worth in Bitcoin, you can lose 10% if it goes to zero. That's all you can lose if you're not leveraged.
Exactly.
But it could go up potentially like hundreds or even thousands of percent. No. The upside is kind of unlimited, depending on how far and how fast we go. If it's going to be the world's reserve currency, and you now own 10% of your wealth in that currency, now guess what? You'll be filthy rich. You'll be one of the you'll be in the top 1% of the world, right? And if not, look, you lose a little bit, but you would probably also lose it in another market downturn. If the rest of it is kind of diversified, you have maybe some real estate, some stocks, whatever. If Bitcoin really goes bust, then probably something else will go up, because there is just value. It needs to kind of balance itself out. But Bitcoin is really the only asset with this asymmetric risk potential, comparison. So it really can go down only that much, but it could potentially go up so much. There's no other asset that has kind of these characteristics. So super good advice. Yeah.
And I think, like, for me, you asked like about my investing. I have a percentage of my Bitcoin that is in a basket of giving back to Bitcoin for things like, Human Rights Foundation or OpenSats or these other open source Bitcoin charities, mm-hmm. and contributing to, like, Geyser Fund is something that I'm proud of that we set up this year, which is have you seen Geyser yet?
No.
Oh, so geyser.fund is the website. It's one of the companies I invested in. And also Geyser Grants is the sort of like charitable arm of Geyser, where we find creators. So the mission is to support Bitcoin creators support Bitcoin culture, Bitcoin education, Bitcoin developers, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So people who have business ideas, people who have books they want to write, podcasts they want to make, code, open source code tools, they liquidity management for Lightning Network, whatever it is, people submit. We do it in rounds. So we just finished round one, where we gave out one Bitcoin, basically. And this was to, I think it was 40 different projects we gave these grants to. And we had like over 80, almost 100 people submit their ideas to round one.
I bet.
Where it was teams from all over the world. Like, there's so many people doing Bitcoin only stuff, mm-hmm. that it's exciting to see all these new folks coming in from all over the world doing Bitcoin education for their communities or their country, or just building tools for Lightning Network and creating art, like books, music, podcasts, all this stuff. So there's, you know, like a percentage of my portfolio, of my net worth, that I'm like allocating towards investing in the Bitcoin ecosystem and investing in Bitcoiners. And I don't think, like, I'm not like super early Bitcoin rich guy that kept all their Bitcoin and like made the best moves, and now I'm like, I can buy a Citadel type of thing. But I am just like a lowly early pleb guy that made a bunch of mistakes and managed to somehow hang on to a life-changing amount of money. So I'm trying to also pay my Bitcoin tithing, because I think that's super important. And I've invested in probably 20 or so Bitcoin companies over the last few years. And it's mostly focused on global adoption of Bitcoin. Because I was that naive financial illiterate person Googling how do I make money online, like, I really relate with the millions of poor people out there that are getting scammed by NFTs and Ponzi scams and right. stuff like that. So I really want to try to focus my investing, the little impact I can have, on trying to push forward educating poor people mm-hmm. about why Bitcoin can change their lives, even a small amount. I really think 0.1337 Bitcoin held until 2030 is going to put you in the top 1% globally. So even a small amount of Bitcoin, 0.1337, will make you part of the global elite if you hold it long enough. And that is attainable for somebody in mm-hmm. Nigeria or somebody in El Salvador. Like, it's a lot of money for that. It is. And mm-hmm. we think about, even when it was like 60K, it was a lot of money even for people in North America. But mm-hmm. I think, you know, 6.15 is the ultimate goal for sure. People want to get the 6.15 Bitcoin for whatever the slogan is. I forget, but it's like big gourds and big citadels or something like that. I can't remember. But for everybody, 0.1337 is a good starting point. Yeah. Put that in your time lock, put that in your multi-sig. That's the Bitcoin you'll never touch, and you will be part of the global elite. So I invest in companies like Galloy Money, which built the Bitcoin Beach wallet, Bitnob, which is like a Bitcoin only exchange in Nigeria.
Like, they're awesome. They're like the relay in Africa. They're like, we try to be exact, like, we try to be the same thing. It's so interesting that there are the same companies literally in every continent popping up. Like, you guys have ShakesPay in Canada or Bull Bitcoin. Then obviously in the US, there's Swan Bitcoin, which is very similar. In Europe, there's Relay and others. And then in Africa, there's Bitnob. It's super, super interesting. Like, in Australia, there's Amber and others.
I'm an investor in Amber as well. Like, any Bitcoin only app I'd love to invest in. I mean, as long as it's not a crazy valuation, because at some point my FOMO sapien brain takes over. If the valuation's too high, I sort of like start to measure it against Bitcoin, thinking like, okay, is this going to beat Bitcoin's returns? Even though the goal of my investing is to support entrepreneurs, like I was, you know, like I wish I had an investor back then who was totally okay with me failing and, you know, and was like just doing what they could to kind of like help push me to success. And so anyways, that's what I want to do. I want to be kind of like hands off when required, just altruistically supporting entrepreneurs building for the mission of Bitcoin only. And there's so many, like you said, yeah, there's like lots of Bitcoin only exchanges and on ramps getting started up all over the world. So like, you know, obviously Relay is the one that I'm interested in investing in, and we're having talks about that right now. And I'd love to be part of your guys' journey because you're doing something awesome in Europe.
Thanks, man. And, appreciate it.
Like, there's also like Bitcoin Mitanni, which is like an education company that this guy Guantai started in Kenya, and he translates Bitcoin articles and Bitcoin podcasts and books and stuff to like five different native African languages, so he can educate folks that don't get like, you know, English news or whatever. That stuff's super important.
That's super important, and that's something that normal, like the quote-unquote normal angel or venture capital investors would never even look at, because this is not something that promises 100x returns or an IPO.
Yeah, I'm probably not
going
to make any money on
it. Yeah, but like this... But
probably
this
won't
is,
make money on that one.
You will indirectly, because you're investing in that adoption in Africa, and this will help... flow the fiat money in the hyperinflating fiat money in the next 10 years flow into Bitcoin. This helps a lot in adoption, and so the price is going up and you're sitting still on Bitcoin, so this price is going up. So indirectly you're totally making the right move.
Well, I more so look at it like I said, it's like Bitcoin tithing, where I probably won't see any returns or anything like that from something like that, but the fact that I'm helping in some way poor people like I was learn about Bitcoin and learn about saving in Bitcoin and ignoring all the noise of trading and crypto and Ponzi scams and all this interest crap, that is worth it for me. Like, and the rest of my portfolio, for sure, I'm sure that I'm having some small effect on Bitcoin rails. And if I'm successful even at some iota at like backing a founder that ends up making a really like scalable company that onboards lots of people to Bitcoin, yeah, I'm going to benefit because I'm holding the majority of my net worth in Bitcoin. So that will benefit me in an indirect way long term. So I don't quite look at my investing as most people do, which is like to beat the returns of Bitcoin. Of course, part of my decision making is like, I hope I'm going to have alpha over Bitcoin gains, but it's going to be very difficult to beat Bitcoin over the next 10 years if it goes to where a lot of us think it's going to go.
Yeah, but
so I don't even really have that perspective.
Yeah, but still, I mean, if you're doing well already with like 20, 25, if you ever have above 20 investments, then the chance is pretty good that one of them is going to go like supernova. And then this will make up for all the other losses. Like this gain is making up for all the others. So this is what venture capitalists obviously do. This is what angel investors do. Like they try to build a portfolio. If as an angel investor, you invest in three or four companies, most likely they will all gonna die and you lose all your money. But if you have 20, then probably 15 are going to die and three or four are doing okay, maybe double your money. But then there's one that's going to 100x your money. It's going to do an IPO at $1 billion valuation. Then, well, I mean, and if Bitcoin is going there where we all think it goes and you are invested in a couple of Bitcoin startups, then I think you're going to do really well.
I think you're right. I'm going to make a note of that. $1 billion. There we go.
No investment advice.
So I need to go and think about what am I going to buy for myself when I get $1 billion from my investing, and then maybe I'll buy that Tesla X.
Well, no, what you're going to do is you're just going to invest in more Bitcoin startups, which is great.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Brad, this has been really good. I need to hop on the call. I'm so sorry. We're already over an hour, I think. And I also don't want to steal more of your time. This was great. I'm very happy to do a second episode, because I think we still didn't even talk about your setup and your neon lights. So so if you want.
Yeah, we need a half an hour for that at least.
Yeah. That's the thing. We started a bit too late. But this has been really, really great, really inspiring. Thank you very much for sharing all these insight, Brad. And yeah, hopefully you will be back soon, and we keep talking, man. Have a great rest of your day. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Cheers, man. Bye.